From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, Iran announced it is strengthening long-standing ties to Syria, perhaps to bolster an Islamic front in the region against the United States. And Tehran warned it will respond to any strike on its controversial nuclear facilities with what it called crushing force. Apparently, European and American diplomacy are not working. Maybe we need to understand this country better. Tonight on Point, we take a step back for an intimate tour of lives and minds in contemporary Iran with author Christopher de Beleg and his new memoir, In the Rose Garden of the Martyrs. But first tonight, we turn to Baghdad on the bloodiest day in Iraq since the January 30th election. At least 35 people were killed and dozens wounded, most in a string of bombings at Shiite mosques and religious processions in and around the capital. Tanasi Kambanis is a correspondent for the Boston Globe in Iraq. I asked him how today's attacks on Shiites, the country's big winners in the election, are being interpreted.
The Shiite majority has lately been a lot more vocal about talking about the fact that they feel directly under attack. In other words, that the series of bombings that began with last year's Ashura bombings, they say, truly are a concerted attempt to provoke the Shia into a civil war. We talked a few days ago with Adel Abdel Mahdi, who's one of the top leaders of the Supreme Council. He said, you know, it's always us doing the dying. It's always us being killed. And these people, he said, want nothing more than to provoke a violent response from the Shia so that they can plunge the nation into a civil war, which he saw as being even worse for everyone concerned. But attacks like these bombings today put a lot of pressure on the Shiite leadership because they're the ones who are begging their people to show restraint. And when a suicide bomber walks into the middle of a crowd of pilgrims and blows himself up, it's very hard, I think, to keep people's tempers cool and to hold them back from doing what so many of them want, which is to form hit squads or impromptu militia to go after the people that they think are responsible.
So the Shia won a narrow majority in the new National Assembly after having been for years, of course, ruled over essentially by the Sunni. Is this seen as a Sunni attack, or are the attackers imagined as more narrowly defined than that? How does the Shiite community understand who's carrying out these attacks?
No one I talk to thinks that the insurgents or fighters behind this kind of attack are any different now than they were before the elections. And they're believed to be a group of Sunni fanatics who are bent on preventing a Shiite majority from taking power in the government. So these folks have been not only targeting mosques and religious figures for more than a year, but they have also gone through and, for example, had concerted ambushes against Shiites driving south from Baghdad to the holy cities of Najaf and Karbala, where they'll pull people out of minivans and ask them to insult Shiite clerics, and if they don't, we'll execute them on the spot and usually leave a few survivors and instruct them to go and tell their fellow Shiites what happened. So these attacks are directly seen as an assault on this majority.
And today, a gruesome attack, I mean a couple, but the one we're reading here at the Kadmayin Mosque in southern Baghdad, an insurgent wearing a belt or vest of explosives stopped by a security guard. They wrangle there. This insurgent sets off the explosives. 15 people die. We're reading here, Tanasi, that the Iraqi National Guard put body parts in a box and buried them inside the mosque. How close to demanding a violent revenge killings is the Shiite community at large? Do you have a sense of how high the fever's running, the anger that must be there in response?
The Shiite community, Tom, has unbelievable depths of patience here. And if you think back to what's happened in the last year and a half and really tally up how many Shiites have been slaughtered in attacks like the one last March, the ones in Karbala and Baghdad, they have shown unbelievable restraint in heeding the calls of their religious leaders to not fight back. The Grand Ayatollah, Ali Sistani, has repeatedly said, we will get our due share through the political process, and until we do, you must not raise arms. And people are even when I talk to them in conversation, for the most part, not contradicting that and not saying, I wish he would let us fight. They often say, you know, the minute Sistani gives me the signal, I will give my life to fight against the people who are doing this to us. But you have to remember the sheer amount of historical crimes perpetrated against these people for the last 25 years, the mass graves that are full of Shiites in the south, the entire neighborhoods and cities that were, you know, cut off of government funds and men press ganged into the armies to fight against the Iran and the war in the 80s. So for the families that have lost four or five people already in the last 25 years, the death toll of the last couple of years seems, frankly, as bizarre as this sounds, seems like an acceptable cost to get to the point of having a government that they control.
They're taking a long view, and of course with the big holy day of Ashura tomorrow, the holiest day of the year for Shiites. Tanasi, just so we have the history in mind here, remind us of what this day commemorates.
Ashura commemorates the day that Imam Hussein was killed on the plains of Karbala in the decisive battle for the succession of the leadership of the Prophet Muhammad. And this is the day that Shia commemorate as the day that they failed to come to the aid of their leader. So it's a day of enormous grief and mourning for having not only lost this battle, but having lost because they did not come to the Imam's aid. What you see in practice on these days is an incredible scene. Thousands upon thousands of men walking from Baghdad to Karbala, beating themselves with chains and chanting funeral dirges effectively for the Imam. You know, men weeping and women weeping and there's sort of ritualistic outpouring of grief that is very raw and unusual to a Western eye.
So a fork in the road between Shia and Sunni going back there to the 7th century. But in spite of these latest assaults, the Shia for now holding their fire, trying to look forward to political power. Tanasi Kambanis in Baghdad, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks, Tom.
Tanasi Kambanis is a correspondent for the Boston Globe. He spoke with me from Baghdad. The streets of Tehran are named after martyrs of Ayatollah Khomeini's 1979 Islamic Revolution against the Shah of Iran and, you might say, against America. Iranians, says journalist and author Christopher Dubeleg in his new memoir, do not smile. They are, he says, in mourning for the death of the Shiites revered Imam Hussein in 680 A.D., for the thousands who died in and before the Islamic Revolution, for the death of as many as 200,000 Iranians in the eight-year Iran-Iraq war with Saddam Hussein that ended in 1988. Iran is an Islamic mullahtocracy where torture and the murder of critics are well known, where premarital sex, drug addiction, and prostitution now rival levels in the West, says our guest, a reporter who visited Iran, fell in love with an Iranian, and settled in Tehran. This hour on Point, an intimate journey inside Iran. You can join the conversation. How do you understand the heart of the country allegedly building nuclear weapons next door to Iraq? Are you afraid of what Iran is? Do you know what it is? And must the U.S. always be the great Satan to Iran? Join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is Christopher Dubeleg. He has been working as a journalist in the Middle East and South Asia for more than a decade. He writes for The Economist, The New Yorker, The New York Review of Books. He lives in Tehran with his Iranian wife, Bita. His new book is In the Rose Garden of the Martyrs, a memoir of Iran. Good evening and welcome, Christopher Dubeleg.
Thank you very much for having me.
It's great to have you. And there's a lot we want to learn tonight. It's a very up-close and personal kind of journey you're conveying here. We should tell us where it began for you. How did you end up in the midst of all this life and revelation in Iran?
It began when I was working as a journalist in Turkey, neighboring to Iran, and I just happened to go there on a story, supposedly for no more than 3 weeks, in 1999 was a very important year for Iran. There was a sense that the reform movement that had started 2 years before was reaching some kind of critical mass. It was a very exciting and interesting time to be there. And during my stay there, I happened to come across, be introduced to a lady who then became my wife. It took me about a year to persuade her to become my wife, but she eventually relented. And so in 2000, I returned to Iran, and I started living there, and I've been living there ever since.
You describe the veterans of Ayatollah Khomeini's revolution, of the war with Iraq, as seeing today's Iran as a parody of the Iran that Khomeini had promised them. Parody in what sense, Christopher?
I think there's a great sense of disappointment among many of the veterans because they raised the revolution and they fought the war for a series of values that were, I think to a certain extent, the values that they associated with Shia Islam and also with the imamates or the early imams of Islam. And these values were very much associated in their minds with social justice and with help for the needy and the poor. And I think what you have now in Iran is a very much more mundane, a very much more commonplace sort of country, the sort of country where materialism is rife, much more rife than they would have wanted, the sort of country where social problems, as you mentioned, such as prostitution, drug addiction and that sort of problem, are at the same sort of levels that you would associate with a Western country. So I think that among many of the veterans of that war, there's a sense that they fought and they expended all this energy and so much fanaticism and so much effort, but for what?
It's a picture that's hard to square with the stern visage of Ayatollah Khomeini that many Americans know from years ago. Christopher Dubleg, please stand by. We're talking tonight about Iran, lifting the veil on an emerging nuclear power. You can join the conversation. How do you understand the heart of a country allegedly building nuclear weapons next door to Iraq? What's your sense of the culmination of Iran's Islamic revolution? What happened to the dream? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are taking an intimate tour tonight through the life and mind of contemporary Iran. My guest is journalist Christopher Dubleg. He's spent a number of years now in Iran, working out of Tehran. He's written a new, what he calls a memoir. It's called In the Rose Garden of the Martyrs. You can join the conversation tonight. What does Iran tell us about the clash and compatibility of Islamic tradition and modernity as you listen to these stories? When and if Iran's nukes are armed and ready, what's your sense of the psychology behind the trigger finger? And what does it mean for Iran to be the great neighbor of both of America's great interventions, Afghanistan and Iraq? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Christopher Dubleg, I hardly know where to jump in. There's so much here, but I guess the first question that your remarks already bring up is, you paint here this picture. Pico Iyer read your book and says, you know, it's this withering portrait of a lost and disenchanted country, heroin addicts, 13-year-old prostitutes, grace notes mocked by the ruins all around. How is it that this kind of social corruption, even degradation that you describe, exists in a country governed by Islamic mullahs who came in with very, very high expectations and standard, at least we thought?
I think it's the probably the story that you could find replicated in many revolutions around the world. The revolution is exactly that. It's a transformation, and it's designed to create an almost unimaginably superb and flawless society. So to that extent, I think probably every revolution is destined to fail and to flatter and then to deceive. And that's certainly what's happened in Iran. I don't think that the picture of social problems that is in my book and which people, reviewers such as Pico Iyer, have brought up is the whole story. It would be wrong to suggest that the whole of the country suffers from this kind of degradation. It's very much an urban phenomenon. And urban problems that you find in Iran do replicate, to a great extent, the urban problems that you find elsewhere. And I don't think that Iran, which is a vast country, is quite as uniform as you might think. I mean, it's a place with very different textures and very different moods. So you can find in Tehran, for example, the sort of teeming metropolis, very, very modern. You can find all this sort of social problem and degradation, really, really major problems. But then you can go into other areas of the country, into more rural areas, and find a much more traditional, a much more slow pace to life, And therefore, the sort of traditional texture of life has been preserved to a much greater extent than it is in the cities.
It's textured. We get that. The texture is all through your memoir. I don't wish, just as an exercise, you are going back and forth these days between Iran and in Europe and now the United States. I wish you'd hold up your sense of, I don't know, the American stereotype or the British stereotype of what's going on in Iran and compare it to what you actually found there. What's the gap between the way the world, or at least the part we're familiar with, sees Iran and the way Iran is?
I think that the first thing to remember, especially that I would urge Americans to remember, since they have spent the past 25 years or 26 years now effectively isolated from Iran for political reasons, the first thing to remember is that in the intervening 25, 26 years, Iran has changed. Now, I think it's important to remember the sort of excess of fanaticism and the excess of anti-Americanism that did exist at the beginning of the revolution. Mm. And that was faithfully reflected among the people who felt this very sincerely. But I think for any American who does go to Iran nowadays, the first thing that he or she will encounter is enormous friendliness and an enormous sense of welcome and hospitality on the part of the people that they meet.
How can that be? We thought we were the great Satan. I mean, that's what the banners said. That's what the chants were. Where does this friendliness come from?
That's exactly right. You're exactly right to point out to the banners and to the chants. What we have now is an Islamic Republic that continues to propagate the official ideology of anti-Americanism. And the interesting thing is, at a time when other parts of the world, and especially other parts of the Islamic world, are genuinely and sincerely reflecting this in their societies, Iran, it is much less the case. Iran has been isolated from Iran for the past 25 years. It has a very, very young society, and these young people are interested in America, are curious about America, and do not feel the same hostility towards America that you can find in many, perhaps all, Islamic countries across the Middle East.
Why is that more so in Iran than elsewhere? Why not the hostility? Do they not have the same madrasas and the same kind of anti-American tone thrumming through their education?
I think that may be exactly the reason why this has become less so. I think that the more that the Islamic Republic is shown to be a normal regime, a normal system of government that is prone to all sorts of failures, that is vulnerable, that has not created the precisely pure and wonderful society that it's set out to. So you find the young people, quite naturally, as young people around the world do, expressing their dissatisfaction by, in some way, embracing that which they are told not to embrace. So, as you say, at school you will find a degree of anti-Americanism being taught. And if you turn on the radio, you will find bilious anti-Americanism. But a lot of the young people and a lot of more thoughtful revolutionaries whose thinking has evolved over the past 25 years are now saying, no, it's not. It's blind and it's self-defeating to have this sort of reflexive anti-Americanism. We have to examine America. We have to be inquisitive about America. So I think that that's really the dominant trait, the dominant thought that is now expressed mostly among young people, but also elsewhere in Iranian society.
So what's the relationship then between the heirs of Ayatollah, or Imam, as he later came to be called, Khomeini, and the mullahs who run Iran today, the mullahtocracy we hear it called, and the broader population? I mean, we hear about stirrings of democratic yearnings, about opposition to the government. What's the relationship? How does the mullahtocracy operate in relation to the Iranian people?
The first thing to recall is that Iran is not, if you say it's a mullahtocracy, it is true that the clerical class is in overall control. But that's not to say that that there is no democratic element in Iranian public life. That's not the case. There are democratic institutions, and they have an uneasy relationship with the clerical system that's superimposed over the top. So it would be wrong to say that every institution in Iran mm-hmm. is completely divorced from public life and is completely unreflective of what the people desire.
So how does the control work, the clerical control?
It's a very ambitious question to try and answer in a few words. Mm. I'd say that you have this electoral system, so some people choose to express themselves politically by turning out and voting in or voting out. How they exercise their ultimate control, a lot of people do still feel a residual loyalty to the Islamic Republic. It's not true to say that all people in Iran are opposed to or desire the fall of the Islamic Republic. But the other thing I think that is a big factor is that many people, even those who are dissatisfied, are politically apathetic at the moment. They have had this experience of a seven-year reform movement, a reform movement that has to a great extent failed to achieve many of the goals that it set out to do. And people put a lot of faith and a lot of enthusiasm and a lot of fervour behind that reform movement. Mm. And now they are apathetic because they've seen that it has failed. And they frankly have not yet worked out who to follow or what to follow as an alternative to that reform movement.
And into that picture comes the enormous fact of the U.S. intervention right next door in Iraq. How do ordinary Iranians perceive, understand, respond to that huge U.S. invasion and presence there?
Well, you seem to express surprise when I said that the Iranians themselves were no longer as anti-American as they were. Now, that's an excellent example. When the Americans invaded and the Brits invaded Iraq, across Europe and in parts of the Islamic world too, there were enormous demonstrations on the streets. In Iran, there was not. There was a sort of deafening silence. Many Iranians approved of that invasion, primarily because they recall the terrible war that took place for 8 years in the 1980s against Saddam, and because Saddam is their primary enemy. Mm. They also recognize that the American invasion could well lead to a preponderance of Shia, to the assumption of power by that Shia majority that we've been hearing about from your earlier correspondent. That was also something that they welcomed. What then happened was that the Islamic Republic was a little bit embarrassed by the sort of apathy that was being showed, and they did call people out onto the streets. But again, that goes back to your early point about banners, about slogans. Mm. There was not, as far as I could detect, enormous enthusiasm or enormous genuine anger among many of those marchers. They were doing so dutifully.
You write about Iran's quasi-colonial history and the sensitivity about that. Is there not sensitivity or fear of the American superpower being next door in Iraq to the west, in Afghanistan to the east? Ordinary Iranians not concerned about that?
Of course they are. They are concerned about that. But it wasn't immediately apparent, and it has not always been apparent, that the American proximity to Iran would be such a threat. The war of words has been escalating. It has not always been at this level. Mm-hmm. And this is the point where Iranians are coming, in many cases, to question whether or not this, for example, the ousting of Saddam and the ousting of the Taliban, both of which had very bad relations with the Iranians, whether or not these two advantageous outcomes are really worth it. Because now what we have is an escalating war of words and a sense of perpetual crisis inside the Islamic Republic. Iran, as I mentioned earlier, is trying to work out the system of reform, is trying to work out the parameters for change, how much you can reconcile Islam and democracy. But at the moment, that whole conversation has been frozen because there's this perpetual idea of crisis and the enemies at the gates. And so the whole system sort of clogs up, and the dominant thought is, well, we can have this conversation, but now is not the time. And so the activists and so the pro-democracy workers are being shut up and they're being kept quiet.
Maybe slowing reform. There's a lot more we want to learn, but I want to begin to invite our callers in. We're talking tonight with Christopher de Beleg. His new book is In the Rose Garden of the Martyrs, all about Iran. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Mike is calling from Spokane, Washington. Hi, Mike. You're on the air.
Hi, Chris. I'm sorry. I'm an Iranian, and I lived here for 20 years. Mm-hmm. And when I left Iran, I was just 19, 20 years old. And I just came back from Iran just 3-4 months ago, and I called. You had another guest. I called, you know, just it was about Iran.
Yes.
I agree with Chris, you know, in some sense. There are, you know, this regime is, you know, is, I mean, everybody agrees, you know, this regime is they put, you know, so much pressure on people. But when it comes to nationality, Iranians, you know, they are united against, you know, this issue of nuclear power plants, and they probably, you know, agree with the regime.
Mike, you're saying that they support the development of nuclear power, even nuclear weapons, Mike?
No. I mean, nuclear weapons is, you know, we are not, you know, we don't know if Iran is actually pursuing that or not. And is, but to, you know, everybody actually is just, you know, in this administration, everybody keeps saying, you know, Iran has so much oil, so it doesn't need, you know, nuclear power plants.
Mm-hmm.
But is, well, you know, as a, you know, international right, we actually have the right to have that. And Iran actually invited the United States to cooperate with Russians.
And you say we, as an Iranian voice there, we'll come
yes.
to that. Let me just ask you as well, Mike, while we've got you, you're just back from Iran, did you see the disenchantment there that Christopher de Beleg describes in his work?
Well, you know, I kind of agree with, like I said, you know, with Chris. Christopher is, I mean, I don't know how long he stayed in Iran. I was out of Iran for 20 years, and I traveled back. And by the way, I came here as a refugee.
Mm-hmm.
I left on my foot over the mountains, you know, through Turkey. And
mm-hmm.
just came here as, you know, when I was 19, 20 years old. And after living here for 20 years, I have been very successful living here, and I went, you know, school, and I have my education.
But when you go back, you see something along the lines that Chris is describing, Christopher is describing tonight. Mike, let's get a response to your question about the nuclear issue or your comment there. Christopher de Beleg, what about this? Of course, this has the world's attention now around the issue of nuclear power plants, but more importantly around the development, alleged development of nuclear weapons. Who's pushing that agenda in Iran, and how deep is public support for it?
Mike made an important proviso. He said that the Iranian government does not accept that it is developing nuclear weapons. So for the Iranian public to answer that question, they have to overcome that that denial and assume that that their government is lying. So you have to make a jump before you can even ask that question.
But they assert that they have every right to, and what we've heard from inspectors is fairly... depending how you look at it, damning in that regard. I mean, the signs, we're told anyway, on the other side of this equation, that it looks like they are developing nuclear weapons.
It's probably fair to say that they are standing by their right to develop nuclear technology that would bring them very close to having a nuclear weapon. This
All
is
right.
what is making the world very nervous.
Mm.
On the question of whether or not Iranians would support that or not, I think there are two points that are worth making. The first is that in normal circumstances, Iranians would look, as they do now, they would look at India and they would look at Pakistan
mm-hmm.
and they would look at Israel.
Okay, why not
and
us?
They would say... these countries are in their immediate or
mm-hmm.
almost immediate proximity and neighborhood, and they would say, well, these countries have either declared or undeclared nuclear capabilities. Why shouldn't we have them? The Iranians are noted for their nationalist sentiments. They feel, as Persians, they feel different from their Arab neighbors. As Persians, they feel different from their Turkish neighbors. And so they would feel, why shouldn't we have this? But I would just like to say one thing about the current debate that is happening in Iran among people. I would like to say that there is no debate about the nuclear question. The people of Iran are much more interested in their daily bread and their daily lives. At the moment, this debate that's going on, the ping pong between America, Europe and Iran, is something that's happening on a much higher level. It's something that seems very divorced and very distant from the normal Iranian on the street. The point when that debate will start to seem more immediate and more real is when there are ramifications. When, for example, in the economic sphere, or perhaps less probably in the military sphere, Iran is there is an intervention or there is more pressure applied, then the Iranians will have to decide, well, is it worth our having this if we're going to pay such a price? But at the moment, there is a sort of unreal sense of distance from this whole issue in Iran.
Do you think that they're too little focused on it, or is the rest of the world too much focused on it?
I think it's just a question of perceptions and it's a question of priorities. I think it's perfectly understandable that the world should be focused on a country that is developing a nuclear program and should be concerned that that program be peaceful and be non-military in intent. But the point that I'm trying to make is that Iranians very often now feel disassociated from the decisions that are taken in their name. So they don't have that engagement. I was talking earlier about an apathy. And I think that also extends to the nuclear issue.
Christopher DeBlake, please, let's hold on for a moment. I've got to take a short break here. We'll come right back to that. The new book is In the Rose Garden of the Martyrs. Christopher DeBlake is with us. You can join us, 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are looking inside Iran tonight, lifting the veil on an emerging nuclear power. My guest is Christopher DeBlake. His new book is In the Rose Garden of the Martyrs, a memoir of Iran. You can join the conversation. What's your sense of the culmination of Iran's Islamic revolution? What happened to the dream? And is U.S.-Iran conflict inevitable? Or is there a path that could be shared amicably? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Tony's calling from Worcester, Massachusetts. Hi, Tony. You're on the air.
Hi. Yes, I am. Just regarding what Chris mentioned earlier, regarding the kind of good feeling that the Iranians have towards America, I'd like to clear that. It's like if you put a person-to-person relation, it's absolutely perfect. It's just like 50% of the population in America that they do not approve of the methods of the government, the steps they are taking. That's basically, they have no love for the American government and their policies around the world, but as person-to-person relations, they really admire American.
Tony, are you Iranian?
Yes, of course.
And do you see any fundamental reason for conflict between the United States and Iran?
Yes, actually, it's instigated from outside the United States, which have incredible influence on American government. And again, as I earlier mentioned,
what do you mean? What are you saying?
Basically, you know, Israel has a thing for them, and you know, and we all know that they have incredible control.
So you're saying Israel's—I don't know—but you're saying Israel's the flashpoint here.
That's the flashpoint, and you know, again, mentality, as far as I can know about Iranians, is, let's put it this way, if the shoe was on the other foot in Palestine, let's say Israelis were being clobbered and, you know, done wrong,
yep,
to them, they would have stand up for them as well, which they have done in the past and the history. You go and look at it.
Tony, we've got it. Let me turn to Christopher DeBlake. Christopher, what about the fundamental relationship between the U.S. and Iran? Are there philosophical, geostrategic conflicts that are inevitable here? And what about the Israel factor?
Well, I think all these things come into play. It's true that Iran is founded on revolutionary, theocratic, and Islamic principles. America has very different ideas about how a country and how the world should be run. And they meet and they conflict in the Middle East. So it's natural that they should have tensions. Whether or not this should necessarily develop into conflict is another matter altogether. I don't think that Israel is quite the flashpoint. Although many Iranians regard Israeli influence over American policy as very important, Israel feels very nervous about the fact that Iran may be approaching the point where it could develop nuclear weapons, and it is possible in the Iranian eyes that they are convincing the Americans to be tough on this. I don't believe that. I think that the Americans have reached their own conclusions about the advisability of an Iranian nuclear program. I think a lot of this is down to history. I think a lot of it in the American mind is down to the hostage taking. I think that was a really defining moment in the course of the relations between the two powers. But that still does not mean that conflict is inevitable. What we have now is a point where the Europeans are saying to the Americans, come on board, join our negotiations, because we cannot offer incentives good enough for the Iranians to give up their nuclear program, which some people regard as a great threat.
But the Americans
are saying they don't deserve the incentive, so we're not going to come on board. And this, it seems to me, is the crux of the situation.
But, of course, the U.S. hostages are not the only history here. There's a lot more around the Shah of Iran, U.S. support there, around the assassination of Mossadegh, But you're saying that Iranians, by and large, are willing to, what, put that aside or, in the right circumstances, have an amicable relationship with the U.S. now in spite of that history?
I don't think that history has never defined any relationships completely between two countries. There's also the matter of actual self-interest. And self-interest on Iran's side dictates that some kind of accommodation be reached with America. Why? Because they're feeling very vulnerable for the reasons that you well know. So it seems to me that were conditions to be created, you would find the Iranians, even the really hardline Iranians, inclined to reach some kind of accommodation.
If they had the chance. Mansour is calling from Westford, Massachusetts. Hi, Mansour, you're on the air.
Hey, good evening, gentlemen.
Good evening.
I just wanted to make a comment and also ask Chris a question. I actually totally agree with all his points, and I actually moved to U.S. about 30 years ago myself. And
from Iran?
From Iran, and I'm going back and forth almost every year.
Okay.
A couple of notes again to Chris's support. Most of the Iranians, 60% of the population is under 30 years old. So they don't remember Shah.
Under 30 years old, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right, and they all got the promises of Islamic Revolution. What I've noticed myself from going back and forth is the fact that Islam as a religious has become less popular to the young. I can, you know, talk about my own family that most everybody used to pray. Now they don't.
Mansour, let me ask you on that. Do you mean it's become less popular than at the height of the Islamic Revolution or even less popular than under the Shah?
Under the Shah, it was more popular.
Wow.
People actually were more religious at the time. And again, to Chris's point, the daily life goes on how to make the ends meet for the family. Young people don't have jobs. And this is what the revolution did not promise them.
That's so, not what anyone expected, Mansour. That is fascinating. Let us run with that, if you would. And thank you for your call. Christopher, what about it there? Mansour is back frequently. He sees less Islamic presence observance today than under the Shah. And here we are on this side of the Islamic Revolution. Does that line up with your observation?
It's absolutely. His comment is fascinating, and I think I'm very substantially correct. It is mostly among the young that there has been a weakening of links to links to Islam and to observance. I know people who are observant, for example, students who are observant, and they say that some of their fellow students tease them for being observant and say, why are you going to pray? Now, this is a complete reversal of the situation that happened at the beginning of the revolution, when if you didn't pray, then your fellow students would behave aggressively against you.
Yeah.
So there has been a very substantial change in attitudes among the young towards their religion. It may be that the fact that this religion is being propagated in a political and ideological way, that is having a negative effect on their adherence to the religion and their loyalty to it. So in the same way that they may say that they like America because they are told not to, it may be that they're distancing themselves from religion for precisely the same reason.
Fascinating. And inside the Islamic Republic, there's an enormous theme that runs through your book, and it's right in the title, the theme of martyrdom. I wish you'd speak to that. I think that may be one of the most difficult themes for Americans to relate to. It's such a low-profile, almost invisible notion in the United States. It's such a high-profile notion and reality in Iran. Why so much focus on martyrdom, and how does it play out in the society's expression of itself?
Well, I think that the sort of preeminent and the supreme expression of that fervor for martyrdom was in the Iran-Iraq War. And there we can find its sort of most complete expression. There you had young men, many of them as young as, you know, in their early teens even, rushing to the front when Saddam Hussein invaded Iran. in order to defend the country, but also in the glorious and joyful knowledge that if they died, they would go to heaven and they would be in paradise for all of eternity. And this was immensely important. It meant that Iraqi soldiers were terrified when they went into battle against Iranian soldiers. And I've spoken to soldiers on both sides, and the contrast between the Iraqis who were terrified and were going to elaborate lengths to desert from Saddam's army, the contrast with the Iranian soldiers who were the exact opposite is very striking. There's a point to be made, and that's that martyrdom within this history of the war has been very much overlooked by the West, and the war has been overlooked by the West. It's important to remember the casualties, the extraordinary destructive effect that that war had on both societies, and the fact that even though we're now living 16, 17 years after the end of the war, that war is still very important. The wounds are still open, and both societies, but Iran in particular, is having to come to terms with that war.
25,000 dead in a single battle in that war. And, of course, the ancient Shiite connection going back to the martyrdom of Imam Hussein, which will be observed tomorrow in the holy day of Ashura. What about the Shia-Sunni split? Does Iran see itself lining up for some kind of... I mean, it's been a perpetual conflict between Sunni and Shia, but do they see the issue of Iraq and the battle lines being drawn there as edging towards some great Sunni-Shia conflict in the Middle East?
I think it's important to keep one thing in mind, that Iran is not interested in conflict. It is not in its interests, because for the reasons that we've been discussing, the Islamic Republic is not nearly as strong internally as it was, and it cannot force more privations and more sacrifice on its people. I think that Iran in Iraq will continue to play what it has done so far, which is largely a pragmatic role. They have cultivated relations not only with clerical Shias, but also with more secular ones. They are keen to stay friends with all the Shias there, and indeed with the Kurds. And I don't think that Iran would be interested in exacerbating any kind of conflagration in Iraq between Sunnis and Shias. And I think they view the kind of sectarian violence that we saw today with enormous alarm, because the last thing Iran wants is a destabilized neighbor whose Sunni Shia violence could conceivably spread across the borders.
We've just got a couple of seconds, but does that mean that their interest in Iraq roughly line up with American interest in stability?
This is the great irony. I think if Iran did not feel that glare of American hostility, if we could just wish that nuclear issue out of the picture, then you'd find a great convergence of interest, not only in Afghanistan, but also in Iraq.
Christopher Dubalek, thank you for the book, and thank you for being with us tonight.
Thank you very much indeed.
Christopher Dubalek, his new book is In the Rose Garden of the Martyrs, a memoir of Iran. Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, a young Iranian-American and her lipstick, Jihad. This is On Point. Azadeh Moveni grew up in Southern California as the child of Iranian exiles. She knew herself to be Iranian, with all the discomfort attached in America to be being associated with the nation that authored the 1979 hostage crisis. She also knew herself to be American, especially when she visited her family in Tehran. In 2000, she returned to Iran as a reporter for Time magazine. In this radio diary, Azadeh Moveni reflects on the challenges of her dual identity and reads from her forthcoming book, Lipstick Jihad, a memoir of growing up Iranian in America and American in Iran.
For 2 years, I worked as a journalist for Time magazine, reporting on the twists and turns of Iranian society through high politics and ordinary life. Since 1998, the revolutionary regime's experiments with political reform, a brief flirtation with democracy, had captured the world's attention. The cultural rebellion of Iranian youth against a rigid traditionalist system fizzed with unknown potential. As a journalist, I arrived during these times with urgent questions. Was Iran really becoming more democratic? What did young people want exactly? Did demographics, two-thirds of the 70 million population is under 30, make change inevitable? Would there be another revolution, or did Iranians prefer this regime to secularize? Were Iranians really pro-American or just anti-clerical? Often there was more than one answer, maddeningly contradictory, equally correct. I came to see Iranian society as culturally confused, politically deadlocked, and emotionally anguished. While the vast majority of Iranians despised the clerics and dreamed of a secular government, no easy path to that destination presented itself. In the meanwhile, revolutionary ideology was drawing its last gasping breath. Its imminent death was everywhere on display. You saw it when Besiji kids, the regime's thug fundamentalist militia, stopped a car for playing band music, confiscated the tapes, and then popped them into their own car stereo. You saw it when the children of senior clerics showed up at parties and on the ski slopes, dressed in Western clothes and alienated from their parents' radical legacy. It was there, outside the courthouse on Vozera Street, where young people laughed and joked as they awaited their trials and lashings before brushing them off and going on to the next party. Iran's young generation, the generation born just before the revolution, or along with it, is transforming Iran from below. From the religious student activists to the ecstasy trippers, from the bloggers to the bed-hopping college students, they will decide Iran's future. I decided I wanted to live like them, as they did, their as-if lifestyle. They chose to act as if it was permitted to hold hands on the street, blast music at parties, speak your mind, challenge authority, take your drug of choice, grow your hair long, wear too much lipstick. This generation taught me how to unlock the mystery of Iran, how nothing perceptibly alters, but everything changes, not by reading the newspapers, but by living an approximation of a young Iranian's life. Today, in a quiet room in a country not far from Iran in space, I am finally unpacking the boxes from those years in Tehran. As I sort through the clothes, peeling veil from veil, it is like tracing the rings of a tree trunk to tell its evolution. The outer layers are a wash of color, dashing tones of turquoise and frothy pink, and delicate chiffons and translucent silks. They are colors that are found in life, the color of pomegranates and pistachio, the sky and bright spring leaves, and fabrics that breathe. Underneath, as I dig down, there are dark matte veils, long, formless robes in funeral tones of slate and black. That is what we wore back in 1998. Along the way, the laws never changed. Parliament never officially pardoned color, sanctioned the exposure of toes and waistlines. Young women did it themselves, en masse, a slow, deliberate, widespread act of defiance. A jihad, in the classical sense of the word, a struggle.
Azadeh Moveni reading from her forthcoming book, Lipstick, Jihad, a memoir of growing up Iranian in America and American in Iran. She lives now in Beirut. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.